This is an ABC podcast.
On RN, you're with The Myths of War, an eight-part series exploring Australia's war history and what's fact and what's not, with historian and writer Mark Dappin.
Itgadal vitgadash shemer rabba. Belma divra chirute v'yamlich machute
v'chayachim. Here I am in Brighton Cemetery at the graveside of General Sir John Monash. It's a simple inscription on the grave. It reads, "To the memory of John Monash, born June the 27th, 1865, died October the 8th, 1931, mourned in love and pride." So it's simply to the memory of John Monash, not Sir John Monash, not General Sir John Monash. It's the Jewish section of the cemetery, so there's a Hebrew inscription, which roughly translated is, "Here lies Yaakov ben Yehada," then something equivalent to, "May his dear soul rest in peace," or "soul be protected." I know that sounds like I can read Hebrew, but I can't. I got somebody from community radio to translate it for me.
"Well, how do you do, Private William McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside?"
I went to Melbourne not to bury Monash. Thankfully, somebody else had already done that. Or to praise him. I was just hoping to find the truth behind the myth. Some years ago, a popular book was published entitled Monash, the Outsider Who Won the War. And ever since then, many of Australia's best military historians have argued that Monash wasn't much of an outsider, and he certainly didn't win the war, at least not on his own. Most commentators agree Monash was disappointing at Gallipoli, where his night approach march during the August offensive ended with tired, inadequately prepared troops getting lost, arriving late, and sustaining heavy casualties. But on the Western Front later in the war, Monash's most enthusiastic admirers credit him with virtually inventing combined arms tactics, that is, having infantry, artillery and armour working together in battle. They apparently believe he pioneered the use of tanks. They think Monash's 90-minute battle at what Australians call the Hamel in July 1918, when the Australians and Americans captured the town that was key to the defence of nearby Amiens, was a brilliant and significant military victory. From a slightly different perspective, many believe Monash was hamstrung by anti-Semitism to the extent that his ambitions were frustrated and his progress through the ranks delayed. These are all issues that raise more passions than you might think. And as author of the book Jewish Anzacs, I've got a bit of skin in the game myself. But here's Brigadier Chris Roberts, author of the well-respected study The Landing at Anzac. Now, Chris, there's a certain cynicism overseas about some strands of Australian military history, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And I think part of the problem is that most of our military history, certainly the popular military history that we see on the bookshelves, is overly nationalistic, it's overly parochial, and it gives an impression of hubris and arrogance. And I think we also have a tendency to criticise the British unfairly, and we also have a very strong tendency to exaggerate our own achievements. Now, the efforts of the AIF on the Western Front in 1916-18 are commendable, and certainly in 1918, but they were hardly decisive. And I think the Australian people really need to know the truth about the AIF in the First World War. They did a wonderful job, but to take them out of the job that they did and put them in a context that, for example, the claim that an Australian Corps commander won the war is just ludicrous, and it brings us into ridicule.
Here's Professor Peter Stanley of UNSW Canberra.
Monash, of course, has always been the most prominent Australian soldier of the Great War. I mean, he did command the Australian Corps in 1918. And indeed, he's the Australian soldier who's received the most biographies. So Monash deserves his eminence. But what's happened in recent years is that justified renown has been inflated. It's been pumped up by admirers who don't actually know a great deal about the First World War, certainly not about the non-Australian aspects of it. So there's been a sort of lack of proportion about Monash. He's now regarded not just as the most prominent Australian soldier, but he's regarded as the genius who probably won the First World War.
So let's talk about what General Sir John Monash actually did in the Great War.
Tell me what you did, the boy once more cried, and proudly the father implored. What did I do in the Great War, lady? What did I do? You want to know?
Monash was an innovator in all sorts of ways. In one way, for example, partly through his personality and his engineering training, he was a very methodical trainer and a very methodical organizer. So things got done, and they got done well under Monash. But the other thing about Monash is that he was an adapter. And his that those who admire Monash, especially people who don't know, who haven't really investigated it, think that Monash invented lots of things, tactical techniques. But in fact, what he did was he adapted and implemented things that had already been invented by other people. And that's one of the roots of the confusion about Monash these days.
In no man's land, one early morn at 6 in the shade, from out the British lines there came the famous Tank Brigade. The Huns began to strap them, couldn't make it out at all, especially when the tanks began the caterpillar crawl. And the tanks went on and they strolled along with an independent air, and their guns began to blare, and the Huns began to swear. But they pulled the trees up by the roots and made the Huns look like galoots at the tanks that broke the ranks out into Cardiff.
There's an idea that Monash pioneered the use of tanks.
Yeah, well, that's nonsense. Tanks became operational in the British service in September 1916. They were used with the Australians at Bullecourt in April 1917, and they were used right through the Passchendaele, the Third Ypres offensive in late 1917. They were used in the huge Cambrai attack in November 1917. So tanks weren't anything new when Monash took command of the Australian Corps. The doctrine was still developing. But Monash didn't invent any doctrine. Probably the only thing that he did which was an innovation, well, two things. One is that Monash made sure that the infantry who were going to be fighting with the tanks got to know the tank crews who were going to operate the tanks. So that was clever of him, because in April 1917 at Bullecourt, the tanks had let the Australian infantry down badly, and the Australians remembered this. So Monash helped restore trust. The other thing he did was that he made sure that tanks were used to bring up ammunition and supplies during the battle, supply tanks, which again, I don't think he invented, but he certainly incorporated into his plans. So he's a great adapter, but not such a great innovator, which is going contrary to what a lot of people these days believe.
Monash is also credited with all kinds of ingenious methodology in planning the Battle of Le Hamel, isn't he, Peter Stanley?
Yes, Hamel's regarded as a sort of apogee of Monash's success, but again, Australians, who would tend to be very parochial about their military history, tend to focus on Hamel and think it's a great victory. Well, Hamel wasn't. It was a sort of a line-straightening raid. It involved 10 battalions. It famously lasted an hour and a half. And it was there basically as a kind of an advert for Monash to show what he and his corps could do. It had no greater significance than that. It's the first time Australians serve with Americans. There are four companies of Americans in the attack. But it's not the war-winning, epoch-making victory that everyone presents it as. Monash was a very methodical, very successful commander, and Hamel is the first demonstration as a corps commander that he's got the goods. But let's not get it out of proportion.
Brigadier Chris Roberts.
Combined arms tactics have been part of military operations for centuries. The use of cavalry, infantry and artillery together and the way in which you use them. What changed in the Great War was the techniques changed. So we have the artillery bringing in the rolling barrage to support the infantry, and the infantry keeping close to that barrage as it goes forward. We also have the introduction of new weapons. We have the introduction of the machine gun. Not that it was an introduction, but in great numbers. We have the introduction of aviation. We have the introduction of tanks. And, you know, as early as 1915, the British are changing their machine gun tactics. They're using aviation in conjunction with artillery for spotting and adjusting guns. When the tanks come on the scene in 1916, the British are looking at ways in which infantry and tanks work together. The French themselves in 1917 are developing infantry-tank cooperation. So by the time Monash becomes a corps commander, and by the time we have the Battle of Hamel, where people say that's where he developed the combined arms tactics, this was all well established.
Here's Dr. Ross McMullen, an award-winning historian who's written a number of books about the First World War.
There are other questions too about whether Monash, in his drive to sort of shorten the war, was too ruthless about pushing the AIF too hard. And there are battles like Mombrahan, the very last one, where Charles Bean and others have, you know, cast great doubts on whether that was necessary. Some very fine men died in that with ultra irony, and right through the war, and then died the AIF's last battle, and which was arguably not necessary at all. Shouldn't have been in it. So we're all human, of course, Monash as much as anybody else, and he's not perfect in all the decisions he made in 1918, but overall he obviously led very, very well.
So, Peter Stanley, where does the Monash legend come from?
Well, the short answer is it comes from Monash himself. We'd have to remember that in 1921, I think, Monash publishes a book called The Australian Victories in France. And in it, he extols the achievements of the Australian Corps in that year of victory. And remember, in 1918, the AIF, the Australian Corps, is part of the victorious Allied armies. Not without cost, there are 34,000 Australian dead and wounded in that last year of the war. Exactly the same number as Australia lost in 1916, which is one of the most terrible years of the war. So Monash isn't saving anyone's lives here, but he is part of that victorious command. And Monash writes a book about this, and it gets published 20 years before the official history gets published. So Charles Bean's official history, volume 6 of his official history, comes out in 1942. In the intervening 20 years, the picture of Australians' victories in France is Monash's. That's how the legend develops.
Here's Dr. Aaron Pegram, senior historian at the Australian War Memorial.
Immediately after the First World War, in December 1918, January 1919, Monash sits down to write his manuscript for what it becomes the Australian Victories in France, and is incredibly self-congratulatory. It should have been called My Victories in France. Monash belts this out in 2 months, and that really sort of sets the tone as for Monash the war winner. And perhaps that comes about because of his fractious relationship with Charles Bean. He doesn't think that Bean is worth his salt in celebrating the Australian victories. And in doing so, Monash kind of beats Bean to the punch by about 20 years, because it's not for another 2 decades before Bean actually releases the volume that deals with Monash's victories on the Western Front in 1918, by which stage Monash has already established himself as a key figure in the very stunning British victory, or British and Allied victory, that occurred on the Western Front in 1918.
Here's Professor Peter Stanley of UNSW Canberra.
And already by, say, 1966, there have already been about 12 biographies of Monash published. From 1966, there's another 12. That's about 22 more than any other general gets. So Monash is first of all, he kickstarts his own legend. And secondly, the legend builds because people keep writing about and talking about and talking up Monash's achievements. And they were not inconsiderable. I mean, this man is in charge of the Australian Corps
in its most successful 6 months. The problem is that more and more honours and more adulation gets loaded onto the Monash legend, and eventually it's at the point now where Monash is presented not just as the most effective Australian commander, he's now presented as being the commander who could easily have succeeded Douglas Haig as commander of the British Expeditionary Force. Well, where does that come from? Well, the answer is it comes from a throwaway line in Lloyd George's memoirs, the British Prime Minister. And Lloyd George wanted to denigrate Haig, who had commanded the BEF, and in order to do this, he hinted that Haig should have been or could have been succeeded by a very skillful Dominion commander, which he meant Monash. Where's the substantiation? Was he ever proposed for it? No. Was he ever in line for it? Well, no, because he was the most junior corps commander in the British Expeditionary Force. Would he likely to have leapfrogged over six corps commanders and half a dozen army commanders? No, of course he couldn't have. So the Monash legend has just been ridiculously inflated.
From my visit to his graveside in Melbourne, I saw how in 1931, Monash was remembered with simplicity. But by 2011, when a smaller memorial was erected in the shadow of his tombstone, his every achievement was listed, from his Bachelor of Civil Engineering in 1891 through to his presidency of the Naval and Military Club in Melbourne. In fact, alongside his wartime activities, the new monument lists all his degrees, including his Master of Civil Engineering, his Bachelor of Arts and Law, and his Doctor of Engineering. It lists his appointment as Chair of the Victorian State Electricity Commission and his leadership roles at the Australian Association for the Advancement of Sciences, the Anzac Day Commemoration Committee, and the Rotary Club of Melbourne, among others. Clearly, he ended his life fairly well connected, but the idea that he was an outsider is based on the facts of his ancestry, Aaron Pegram.
What's interesting about Monash is that he does have a Prussian Jewish heritage. And of course, this plays a very important role as to who the man actually is. That notion that Monash was an outsider stems from the fact that he has his German Jewish background. He has this remarkable capacity for learning at a very young age. He goes off and studies engineering and completes university degrees in arts and law and engineering, and he becomes quite an accomplished engineer in the decades before the First World War. In fact, he's one of the very early Australian proponents of concrete reinforcement in Australia. He has a career in the civilian military forces that spans nearly 30 years before the outbreak of the First World War. Engineering has made Monash incredibly rich. He is in the inner swim of local business affairs in Melbourne. He knows prime ministers. He lunches with governor generals. Even though he is German and Jewish, he's certainly not an outsider. In fact, you know, all that evidence would suggest that he was in many respects an insider. That myth comes about from his treatment during the First World War by other commanders, and certainly his relationship with Charles Bean, who's the official Australian war historian. In 1918, Bean conspires against Monash for the command of the Australia Corps. He's betting on the other candidate, Cyril Brudenell-White, in commanding the Australia Corps.
Even before the formation of the Independent Australian Corps had been approved, Bean and another influential war correspondent, Keith Murdoch, had cabled Prime Minister Billy Hughes to warn against appointing Monash as Australian Commander-in-Chief. "We do not want Australia represented by men, mainly because of their ability, natural and inborn in Jews, to push themselves," wrote Bean. And as the war went on, he continued his whispering campaign against Monash and his Jewish capacity for worming silently into favour without seeming to take any steps towards it. And Will Dyson, Australia's first official war artist, predicted Monash would get the job as "he must always get there on time on account of the qualities of his race. The Jew will always get there." Monash did win command of the new corps from the 1st of June 1918. His Jewishness had, of course, worked against him rather than in his favour, but this was impossible to grasp for high-born men like Bean, who accepted success as a birthright.
Bean was a man of his time, and one of the things that Protestant gentlemen did was denigrate Jews. Monash was not only a Jew, but a Jew of German-Polish background. And so Bean reflects the sort of anti-Semitism that was very rife. But it is true that Bean had reservations about Monash, not about his technical competence, but about what Bean saw as a character flaw, that Monash would push himself because he saw that Jewish people would do that. But Bean changed his mind. I mean, one of the extraordinary things about Charles Bean is that he retained a sort of mental flexibility, an agility. And while he'd written in his diary in 1918 that he thought Monash was not the right man for the job because he was pushy and Jewish and so on, later in life, he actually inscribes in the diary, "I was wrong about this."
Now, the prejudice against Monash was a process, wasn't it? It began with a whispering campaign about him simply being German.
Right through the war, Monash is criticised. So in 1914, there are whispers that he's of German descent and therefore isn't trustworthy. He has to write to his family and say, for goodness sake, don't write to me in German because it'll be interpreted that I'm disloyal. But it doesn't stop Monash being rewarded. So he's a senior militia colonel in 1914. He gets the 4th Brigade of the Australian Imperial Force in 1914, takes it to Gallipoli. And even though he's not very successful on Gallipoli, I mean, his shortcomings are quite apparent, he still gets command of the 3rd Division in 1916. So his skills are recognised and rewarded. In 1918, he gets the command of the Australian Corps. So none of the rumours or the innuendo or the frankly racial prejudice directed towards Monash actually makes a difference to the way Monash's career develops.
It seems to me Monash's legend has just grown and grown in the last decade or so.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. And I think that is a reflection of how the Australian public is learning more and more about Australia's First World War history. And for many decades, the popular memory of Australia in the First World War was Gallipoli, most notably enshrined by the Peter Weir film. And I think within the last 10 years, we've seen more and more people look at visiting the Western Front, for starters, and also reading about it. We've had quite a number of quite popular works, including Les Carlines' The Great War and Gallipoli volumes as well, telling the popular story of Australia on the Western Front and, in the First World War more broadly. So I think as part of that, Monash plays a crucial role. And I think some of the arguments for perhaps retrospectively promoting Monash to a field marshal, which I don't think would have been a good thing. Monash was never in a position to be awarded a field marshalship. He may have actually commanded an army command had the war continued, but of course that's the next logical step. Being a field marshal is a step above that. I think that would have been misguided. I mean, some of those myths and stereotypes originate from the war years, but only now with the benefit of hindsight, I think historians are in a better position to challenge some of them, of course, tell it to the Australian public.
And that's what we're all about on Myths of War. I'm Dr. Mark Dappin. Thanks for joining us. In our next episode, Changi. Was it really a hell camp for prisoners of the Japanese? And if so, why did one famous inmate refer to it as POW heaven? See ya.
You've been listening to The Myths of War with historian and writer Mark Dappin. You can listen back or download all 8 programs in this series. You'll find them on the RN homepage or via the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.